Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. Don't forget that you can find out what's coming up on our show by going to Red State Talk Radio podcast page on our reclaimingtherepublic.org domain or website. Now, this show is also sponsored by reclaimingtherepublic.org. You can tell I want to get into the content instead of trying to get into a diatribe, because I lose the whole segment when I start ranting. And this is also sponsored by republicreview.org. You are listening to the only show that provides the academic evidence and the academic solution based on that evidence. And so if you want to be a part of the solution, this is important. If you want to be a part of the solution, you can. All you've got to do is get engaged with Republic Review. There's different ways you can do this. Most important way you can do this is become a champion for the Constitution and run for office. Now, that we've had people that have run for office that told us that they would be a champion for the Constitution. What I mean, this is a very specific being champion. In other words, if you're going to become a champion for the Constitution, you will demand full compliance. You're not just going to say, oh, I want to make sure we keep our Second Amendment rights. The Constitution is more than, it doesn't start off with the Second Amendment, and that's it. The Constitution has a lot of meat to it, and it delegates very specific powers. And more importantly, the federal government must be forced back, politically forced, not with, you know, military or, you know, what do we call those? With lethal force. We do not need to use lethal force. What we need to do is we need to force the federal government using political force back into the framework of the Constitution. This is a political war. We are in the throes of a political and an ideological civil war since the beginning of time. We have always been fighting for liberty against subjugation, whether that be subjugation to a throne, whether that be subjugation to a Caesar or a czar or whatever. Monarchies, communism, it does not matter. And so we will just go ahead and dive forward. Once I tell you that we would love to have you join us in our listener drive in growing our listening audience, please send out emails. Please encourage people to start picking up this message so that people can understand the importance. I mean, what have you done? I mean, if you actually agree with the concepts and what we're talking about, then why is it that you're not at least saying, hey, you've got to tune in, you've got to at least listen. This guy is not a professional or the epitome of a conservative entertainer. I'm not here to entertain. My whole purpose and focus, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little tongue-tied today. That's always my frustration. And I'm going on a rant, and I recognize that. But this is all about the listener drive. Our whole purpose and intent is to obtain compliance by using Republic Review and teaching people about this. I may not be able to, you know, quickly articulate, but then again, I'm not one of those few people that just have to say the same thing over and over again when you listen and it's just pro-Trump or anti-Trump or whatever. Fact of the matter is we need you to get involved, and one way you can get involved is either politically jumping into the fray as well as helping us with our listener drive. Again, we have all of our podcasts, or these shows, up on the Red State Talk Radio podcast page on our website. Now, we also have a sponsor. It is Red State Coffee. If you happen to consume coffee on a regular basis or even on an occasional basis, why isn't it Red State Coffee that you're purchasing? You can always put your own favorite creamers to change the taste or what have you. Bottom line, if you're supporting the show that way, then you are actually, you know, helping us even further. We can use all the help, and we humbly accept all the help that you're willing to offer. Now, let me, I think I've kind of covered everything. We're still in the Virginia ratification debates. We will close on the New York ratification debates when that time comes. But that being said, what we want to do is we want to kind of pick up kind of where we left off. And so we're going to start off regarding the militia. And there's a lot of content in the Virginia ratification debates about the militia. The reason I'm including all of this is just due to the fact that you have to understand that the militia is the integral part of enforcement of constitutional laws. It is the integral part of why we even have a Second Amendment. We don't have the intent by the framers was just not to say, oh, we want to make sure that the people, we want to make sure that the people of this country can always have guns for whatever purpose they desire, that it cannot be taken away. That's not the intent of the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment is the charge that requires all citizens to participate in the enforcement of this Constitution. That's why the oath of citizenship, as well as the oath of service, requires that you, that you will support and defend the Constitution. You are obligated as a citizen. And even as a public servant, your obligation goes higher. If you ask me, the one thing that they should have done, they should have actually included, but then it would have been punitive. In Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, they should have included that a person, you know, if a public servant actually goes and violates their oath of office, and they do not support the Constitution, they support rebellion, they support communism and the overthrowing of our Constitution. Excuse me, I got a frog in my throat today. I apologize. What we're trying to tell you is that if somebody violates their oath of office, then they should also lose their citizenship or their ability to vote, to participate in the process that they have actually been violating and defying. I'll get this frog eventually. I probably need to get a gun or call for the militia. Anyway, this is Mr. Corbin. And Mr. Corbin is, again, questioning the, you know, the I believe he's questioning the common sense and the logic behind this opposition. Now, there's Mr. Clay, who, so got Clay and Corbin. And actually, I'll just tell you a little backstory on this, because this is very good. Corbin was a very young man, and he idealized, he was a huge fan of Madison. And so he sent Madison letters of how can I help and so forth, and he tried to befriend him. And I think that there was, Madison recognized that there was probably some shortfalls or shortcomings regarding, you know, Corbin's personality. You know how somebody kind of, they just rub you the way they go, I don't know if I want to be that close and attached to this person. Anyway, Mr. Corbin at one point in time during the debates actually insulted Mr. Henry because Mr. Henry was bantering back and forth. And so he insulted him. And everybody was aghast. Everybody thought that, okay, Henry's going to challenge this guy to a, you know, to a duel. But what Mr. Henry did, and this is a kudo to Mr. Henry, he defused the situation and humiliated Mr. Corbin by, you know, over-exaggerating a bow to him, you know, like he was basically implying that Mr. Corbin was trying to assert that he was the king of the room or something. And so at that point in time, and maybe this was the straw that broke the camel's back, or at least created the warning in Madison's mind that this guy goes a little too far, because we have to have mutual respect. Now, I'm telling you that all of these men embraced liberty. They were all fighting for liberty and making sure, and the reason they were fighting back and forth was over this cause of liberty. There were only a few men like Marshall, and Hamilton and others that were involved in this process that actually had underlying machinations and designs that, okay, once we get this thing going, once we get this federal government going, we will begin pushing and making implications of what we want this government to do. And so, you know, you could actually see that was done by Hamilton. And there were others that actually joined in because the people that hated Britain were called Anglophiles. And those who loved them, I don't know what their names were, but they were actually the those who wanted to continue to embrace monarchism or a monarchy within our system. And Hamilton was one of those people. Marshall was another one of those people. Anyway, actually, I just looked, and I apologize. I just wasted the entire first segment when I wanted to get into Mr. Corbyn's comments regarding the militia. And so I'll just start off with the first paragraph. The honorable gentleman then urges an objection respecting the militia, who he tells us will be made the instrument of tyranny to deprive us of our liberty. Your militia, says he, will fight against you. Who are the militia? Are we not militia? He's defining it right there. We are all a part of this. Shall we fight against ourselves? No, sir. The idea is absurd. We are also terrified by the dread of a standing army. It cannot be denied that we ought to have the means of defense and be able to repel an attack. And from that point, that closes off the first paragraph. We will be right back after these two promos with the remainder of Mr. Corbyn's comments. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
So one of the things that I forgot to mention is that Mr. Corbyn is addressing Mr. Henry, Patrick Henry. What ended up happening was, and this is like the first statement on Saturday, the 7th of June, and Mr. Henry spoke on Thursday afternoon. He was the second to last. So all day Friday, it was Governor Randolph, then Mr. Madison, then Mr. Nichols. And so it was three Federalists that spanned the debate, adding in response to before Henry actually got up and spoke again. And then, so Mr. Corbin is now also basically haranguing Henry on his incorrect perception. And so Henry then gets up and rebuffs Mr. Corbin. This might be that point in time where it was a perceived insult. I don't know. But anyway, it's a nice little side story regarding the respect and how they handled each other. And when you get to that point where people feel that you've crossed the line and impugning their character, you know, there's a duel coming forth. Anyway, let me get back to what we were talking about. And so we just read the first paragraph, so we're going to start on the next paragraph. If some of the community are exclusively inured or trained in its defense, and the rest attend to agriculture, the consequence will be that the arts of war and defense and of cultivating soil will be understood. Agriculture will flourish and military discipline will be perfect. So he's talking about, you know, this concept of how we're supposed to maintain the militia in all of the different counties and so forth. If, on the contrary, our defense is solely entrusted to militia, ignorance of the arms and negligence of farming will ensue. The former plan is, in every aspect, more to the interest of the state. By it, we shall have good farmers and soldiers. By the latter, we shall have neither. If the inhabitants be called out on sudden emergencies of war, their crops, the means of their subsistence, may be destroyed by it. If we are called in the time of sowing seed or of harvest, the means of subsistence might be lost, and the loss of 1 year's crops might have been prevented by a trivial expense if appropriated to the purpose of supporting part of the community exclusively occupied in the defense, of the whole. I think I got rid of that frog, though. Exclusively occupied in the defense of the whole, I conceive that this idea, if it be a new one, is yet founded on solid and very substantial reasons. But, sir, we are told of the expediency and propriety of previous amendments. What end would it answer to attempt it? Will the states which have adopted the Constitution rescind their adopting resolutions? So he's basically set up all this stuff, and now he's basically saying, hey, if now all of a sudden we are going to amend this Constitution in this process, because to be clear, Virginia, actually Henry and the Anti-Federalists and his crew had set up this argument to try to create amendments to the Constitution that they would ratify it on those terms only. And so Mr. Corbin's basically saying here that, you know, going down this path, you know, what is to be said of those who have already ratified the Constitution as is, and now we're throwing in something new without going through the full process? Had we adopted it, would we recede from it to please the caprice of another state? Pride, sir, revolts at the idea. Admitting this state's purpose amendments admitting this state proposes amendments previous to her adoption, must there be another federal convention? Must there also be a convention in each state? Suppose some of the proposed conditions to be rejected, will not our exclusion out of the Union be the consequence? Or would other conventions again be called and would be eternally revolving the devising expedients without coming to a final decision? The loss of the Union, sir, must be the result of the pretentious demand of precedent conditions. My idea is that we should go hand in hand with Massachusetts, adopt it first, and then propose amendments of the general nature, for local ones cannot be expected. Consider the situation of Massachusetts commanding the North and the importance and respectability of Virginia to the South. Now, you got to understand, Virginia and Massachusetts were the most populated areas. Even New York hadn't got there. You got to remember New York, as I think I've mentioned this before, New York was actually a colony of Holland until a bunch of Englishmen moved in there and they changed the allegiance to the British crown. Anyway, going back to this, consider the situation of Massachusetts commanding the North and the importance and respectability of Virginia to the South. These, sir, are the two most populous, wealthy, and powerful states in the Union. See, that's what I just said. Is it not very probable that their influence would have great weight in carrying any amendments? Would any gentleman turn a deaf ear to their solicitations? By union alone, we can exist. By no other means can we be happy. Union must be the object of every gentleman here. I never yet have heard any gentleman so wild and frantic on his opposition to avow an attachment to particular confederacies. By previous adoption, the union will be preserved by insisting on adult alterations previous to our adoption. The union may be lost and our political happiness destroyed by internal dissensions. I trust, therefore, that this convention, after deliberate discussion, will not hesitate to determine on the previous ratification of a system which, even in its present form, seems competent to the perpetual preservation of our security and happiness. And then Henry, I'm going to actually read this, and then Henry arose and expressed a desire that the honorable gentleman on the other side, Governor Randolph, should continue his observations on the subject he had left unfinished the day before, that he had before and would now give him a patient hearing, as he wished to be informed of everything that gentleman could urge in defense of that system, which appeared to him so defective. And then Randolph gets up and so forth. But anyway, the next part that I want to read, which I've actually read, my apologies, was the point in time when Madison actually got up and basically recapitulated many instances of the prevalent system. This is what he says. He basically goes over the prevalent persuasion, and the reason this is in brackets is because they couldn't really make it out, so they kind of summarize what they heard, because this was one of those points in time when Madison was speaking that he was not audible throughout the entire discourse, and so there's plenty of little flags when somebody that was speaking couldn't really be heard by the scribes. So they either tried to summarize what they deduced, and this is very small fragments. There's very few fragments within it that, actually don't provide any detail, any statements or anything else. It's just literally we couldn't hear what he was saying. If you understand, though, we've got hundreds of pages, right? Hundreds of pages of what they could hear and what they did document, and none of them are dissimilar. None of them are, disharmonious. They are all harmonizing and dovetailing on the same concepts and principles as they were constantly, and they were very consistent in how they were defining the Constitution. And I'm just here to tell you that usually when over a course of weeks there is a consistency in, telling you this is how it is, then it's not like they're making it up as they go along. Because if all of a sudden they found holes and they said, oh, well, yeah, that's an incorrect impression that we may have given you. There's none of that here. None of it. It's always constantly saying, no, this is an enumerated constitution. What part of that don't you understand? We don't need a Bill of Rights. Anyway, moving forward, then Mr. Lee gets up and he makes a comment regarding the militia as well. And he says, our men fighting with the troops of that king whom he so much admires, I have seen proofs of the wisdom of that paper on your table. I have seen incontrovertible evidence that the militia cannot always be relied upon. I could enumerate many instances, but one will suffice. Let the gentleman recollect the action of Guilford. the American regular troops behaved there with the most gallant intrepidity. What did the militia do? The greatest number of them fled. Their abandonment of the regulars occasioned the loss of the field. Had the line been supported that day, Cornwallis, instead of surrendering at Yorktown, would have laid down his arms in Guilford. This plan provides for the public defense as it ought to do. Regulars are to be employed when necessary, and the service of the militia will always be made use of. This, sir, will promote the agricultural industry and skill and military discipline and science. And so we'll pick up right there where we just left off. It's the next paragraph. So he's basically talking about the importance of this system and the training and the uniformity that did not exist in the Confederacy and during the Revolutionary War. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TALK-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Another thing I want to point out before I get back into Mr. Lee of Westmoreland's comments regarding Mr. Henry's constantly fussing and saying this is a dangerous system. The reason why Mr. Henry was very patient with Governor Randolph was because Governor Randolph was against the Constitution until the debates. And he was constantly being called out by Henry and other Federalists. And if, as you read through Governor Randolph's comments, many times he actually had to defend himself that he was against this. But now that we're in a position where we can actually ratify and submit amendments to this so that we actually speak forth of saying we need these things to be done, the Bill of Rights. It was all about the Bill of Rights. And anyway, so Henry was always looking to get Governor Randolph to stand up, and the Federalists wanted to keep him up because he was the flip-flopper. And just like with Kerry, you know, and the Bush election campaign, when was that? I think 2004. And so how everybody was always mocking and how people, you know, had flip-flops, you know, the shower shoes, whatever you want to call them, beach shoes, sandals. they had flip-flops with Kerry's name on them and so forth because they were haranguing him and they were giving him a hard time because he flip-flopped on issues. And so this is exactly what they were doing with Governor Randolph. And that's why Mr. Henry said, I want to give the governor more time. Anyway, so Mr. Lee of Westmoreland's finishing comments that I want to read for you is, I cannot understand the implication of the honorable gentleman that because Congress may arm the militia, the states cannot do it. And that's not a question. He says, nor do it. He's basically saying that the states cannot do it. Of course they can do it. Do I understand the reverse of the proposition? The states are by no part of the plan before you, precluded from arming and disciplining the militia? Should Congress neglect it? In the course of Saturday and some previous harangues from the terms of which some of the northern states were spoken of, one would have thought that the love of an American was in some degree criminal, as being incompatible with a degree of affection for a Virginian. The people of America, sir, are one people. I love the people of the North, not because they have adopted the Constitution, but because I fought with them as my countrymen and I consider them as such. Does it follow from hence that I have forgotten my attachment to my native state? In all local matters, I shall be a Virginian, and in those of a general nature, I shall not forget that I am an American. And so that was a pretty interesting comeback clarifying that, you know, these states, as a citizen, you had your countrymen, and then you had the greater nation. Their concepts, and if you read how they spoke and talked, even Jefferson talked about his countrymen, his country, Virginia. Even when he was president of the United States, he still referred to Virginia as his country, and he still referred to the America or the United States as a confederacy. And that goes to, you know, to support this concept that our republic is a hybrid constitutional republic. It's not a federation in nature. It's not a confederation in nature. It's both. And so anyway, let me get to Governor Randolph's notes now. And this is what Governor Randolph says. Another construction he gives is that it is exclusively in the power of Congress to arm the militia and that the states could not do it if Congress thought proper to neglect it. I am astonished how this idea could enter into the gentleman's mind. Now, I would say this. I'm going to just stop right here. One of the things that they never threw out there is to say, hey, if Congress fails to arm and train and, you know, exercise the militia to maintain uniformity, then the states should actually pick up that cost and withhold that money from the federal government and say, hey, you have been failing to do this, and we're not paying these taxes because of that. Now, who are you going to have to enforce it? Because bottom line, the states and the militias, they're going to support the Constitution. They're going to say, hey, look, you have a constitutional responsibility to fund us. You have a constitutional responsibility to ensure that, you know, we're, you know, equipped, trained, and so forth. And we have the uniform discipline. Anyway, moving on, he says, whose acuteness, let me go back to where I, the beginning of this sentence. I am astonished how this idea could enter into the gentleman's mind, whose acuteness no man doubts. How can this be fairly deduced from the following clause? To provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part as of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. He complains much of implication, but in this case he has made use of it himself, for his construction of this clause cannot possibly be supported without it. it is clear and self-evident that the pretended danger cannot result from this clause. Should Congress neglect to arm or discipline the militia, the states are fully possessed of the power for doing it, for they are restrained from it in no part in the Constitution. And so what he just said, that there is no part in the Constitution that constrains them or restricts them from doing it, this is because Article 1, Section 10 are the actual specific restraints placed upon the states. So actually, the Constitution had restraints on not just the states in Section 10 of Article 1. Section 9 of Article 1 created additional restraints placed upon Congress or the federal government, period. And so now Governor Randolph goes into the sweeping clause. He says, the sweeping clause, as it is called, is much dreaded. I find that I differ from the several gentlemen at this point. Or on this point, the formidable clause does not in the least increase the powers in Congress. It is only inserted for greater cautions to prevent the possibility of encroaching upon the powers of Congress. No sophistry and no sophistication will be permitted to be used to explain away any of these powers, nor can they possibly assume any other power but what is contained in the Constitution without absolute usurpation. So that term right there, absolute usurpation, if you look at what the federal government is doing with the Department of Transportation, the Department of Energy, the Department of Education, all of these things that are not enumerated in the Constitution, Governor Randolph calls these absolute usurpations. Another security, Mr. Governor Randolph says, is that if they attempt such a usurpation, the influence of the state governments will nip it in the bud of hope. I know this government will be cautiously watched. The smallest assumption of power will sound the alarm to the people and followed and bold and active opposition. I hope that my countrymen will keep guard against every arrogant power. I shall take notice that the honorable gentleman said with respect to the power to provide for the general welfare, the meaning of this clause has been perverted to alarm our apprehensions. The whole clause has not been read together. It enables Congress to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and for the common defense and welfare of the United States. To pay the debts and provide for the common, so in other words, the common welfare and defense is the common welfare for the security and those things that are delegated. This did not grant any new powers. That's GR speaking. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States, close quote. He's reading out of the Constitution. That was the preamble of Section 8, or the enumeration of powers. The plain and obvious meaning of this is that no more duties, taxes, and excises shall be laid than are sufficient to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Now, getting back to these usurpations and so forth, it is very, very clear that what ended up happening, because Governor Randolph is saying, hey, you know, the states are going to be jealous of this new government. What ended up happening, because, and I've said this and I'll say this time and time again, every state should have kept these ratification debates in their possession and should have referred to them every time the federal government started to drift. In other words, hey, here's the contract, and here's the definitions of this contract, and you're telling us one thing, and the definitions of the contract completely conflict with what you're trying to tell us or sell us, close quotes. So I'm here to tell you that had we actually maintained these ratification debates and gave them to every state that joined the union, we would not have been duped by these people that we considered brilliant men, noble men, and doing all sorts of good things by creating unconstitutional footings that would be our demise 2 centuries later. That, my friends, is the reality of how we've gotten into this terrible position, because the states actually believed Marshall and Hamilton, and down the road, as these men continued to grow their implied powers, it became insatiable. They just wanted to consume everything. We will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, Red State Talk Radio has brought back its monthly newsletter. I know everyone gets a lot of emails, but this is not a daily or weekly newsletter. It's a monthly newsletter. So you will not be overwhelmed with a plethora of emails from Red State Talk Radio. Come on, it's only once a month. I'll be contributing a constitutional perspective to one of the current issues to help everyone see an alternative perspective, or what I believe would be a framer's perspective regarding the issue, to help us maintain a constitutional paradigm. I will also provide information regarding a significant historical context to the time of year so that we can remember our history, so we will not be doomed to repeat the inevitable failings from forgetting our past and origins. Just go to Red State Talk Radio and sign up for the newsletter. This way you can get a focused view of what is going on in the Republic as well as what is going on at Red State Talk Radio. Thank you.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so we're getting back into the final paragraph of Randolph's comments, and then Mr. Monroe is going to get up, and so, but we won't get into what he basically says in response. But I will say this, that as we, you know, go through this, I think you can start. You should have already seen all of this stuff, but the detail and the definition and the focus, that the clarity, there's a better word, the clarity that we are garnering from these Virginia ratification debates is so intense. I mean, it's like going from 1960s black and white television to 4K definition, or even, you know, the what do you call that? The details of like IMAX, you know, that just quality of the details and focus and so forth. And it's just like, wow. All of these things that we thought we knew about the Constitution, because this is what the so-called experts, air quotes here, the experts have sold us and have told us. We now know the truth. We now understand the facts that we have been lied to, we have been duped, and that the Constitution has been stretched to its limit. Unfortunately, we have so many constitutionally illiterate politicians. Trump's one. It's not his fault. But we've all become illiterate, or I should say 99% of America is illiterate on the Constitution, because we have obscured the truth from these ratification debates. It's that simple, friends. And so this is the truth. If something happens to me, because I, as I move forward and as I progress forward, there's no doubt in my mind the crosshairs will be on me, because there is trillions of dollars in global control at stake. If America pulls back out of the globalist agenda, it won't kill the globalist agenda, but it will thwart its ability to enforce and everything else, because the natural consequences of America actually getting back onto the constitutional path that the framers put us on, we will then be open to and allowing states to actually come aboard with the United States in our constitutional republic experiment, the proven experiment of liberty. And so what would the essence or the outcome and consequences of us pulling back and these things happening, the UN will be disbanded. The only countries propping up the UN will be communist countries, countries that are seeking to subjugate, and over time, the people, even in those countries, like what's going on in China, they revolt, they try to revolt, but the iron fist of tyranny constantly knocks them back. And so, anyway, let me get back to this last paragraph by Governor Randolph. If you mean to have general government at all, ought it not be empowered to raise money to pay the debts and advance the prosperity of the United States in the manner that Congress shall think most eligible? Now, when they talk about the, you know, advancing the prosperity, it's protecting us in our trade, protecting us from having our trade stolen. For it, because at this point in time, we were just a small country that was being harassed by Britain, being harassed by the Ottoman Empire, and who knows who else would come along and harass us. And actually, we have coming up, some comments from Madison regarding neutrality and the importance of being a respectful nation, but a strong nation and a neutral nation. But anyway, we'll get to that in another episode because we're running out of time. But what Mr. Randolph then says is, what is the consequence of the contrary? You give it power by one hand and you take it away by the other. If it be defective in some parts, we ought to give due credit to those parts which are acknowledged to be good. Does the prohibition of paper money merit our approbation? I approve of it because it prohibits tender laws, secures the widows and orphans, and prevents the states from impairing contracts. I admire that the part which forces Virginia to pay her debts. If we recur to the Bill of Rights, which the honorable gentleman speaks of so much of, we shall find that it recommends justice. Had not this power been given, my affection for it would not have been so great. When it obliges us to tread in the path of virtue, when it takes away the most influential man of the power of directing our passions to his own emolument and trampling upon justice, I hope to be excused when I say that were it mote objectionable, and actually I think that should have been most, that's probably a typo, that were it most objectionable than it is, I should vote for the Union. And so, interesting closing comments. Now, we get into Mr. Madison's comments, and these are kind of lengthy, so let me just plow through these, and I'll try not to editorialize so much. The subject of direct taxation is perhaps one of the most important that can possibly engage our attention, or that can be involved in the discussion of this question. Now, I keep telling people, and if you hear people say that the government does not have the constitutional authority to, you know, for direct taxation, especially if we got rid of the 16th Amendment, what the heck are they saying here? This is Madison saying the subject of direct taxation is perhaps one of the most important and can possibly engage our attention, or that can be involved in the discussion of this question. If it to be judged by the comments made upon it by the opposers and favors of the proposed system, it requires a most clear and critical investigation. The objections against the exercise of this power by the general government, as far as I am able to comprehend them, are founded upon the supposition of its being unnecessary, impracticable, unsafe, and accumulative of expense. I shall therefore consider first how far it may be necessary, second how far it may be practicable, and third how far it may be safe as well with respect to the public liberty at large, as to the state legislatures, and fourth, with respect to the economy. First, then, is it necessary? I must acknowledge that I concur in opinion with those gentlemen who told you that this branch of revenue was essential to the salvation of the union. It appears to me necessary in order to secure that punctuality which is necessary in revenue matters. Without punctuality, the individuals will give it no confidence, without which it cannot get resources. I beg gentlemen to consider the situation of this country. If unhappily the government were to be deprived of this power, let us suppose for a moment that one of those powers which may be unfriendly to us should take advantage of our weaknesses. And he's talking about the foreign powers, which they will be more ready to do when they know the want of this resource in our government. Suppose it should attack us. What forces could we oppose to it? Could we find safety in such forces as we could call out? Could we call forth a sufficient number, either in droughts or any other, to repel the powerful enemy? The inability of the government to raise and support regular troops would compel us to depend on militia. It would then be necessary to give this government power, or give this power to the government, or run the risk of national annihilation. It is my firm belief that if a hostile attack were made at this moment on the United States, it would flash conviction on the minds of the citizens of the United States of the necessity of vesting the government with this power, which alone can enable it to protect the community. I do not wish to frighten members into a concession of this power, but to bring it to their minds those considerations which demonstrates its necessity if it were secured from the possibility or probability of danger, it might be unnecessary. I shall not review the concourse of dangers which may probably arise at remote periods of futurity, nor all of those which have been immediately to apprehend, for this would lead me beyond the bounds which I have prescribed myself. But I will mention one single consideration drawn from this fact. I hope I have your attention. By the treaty between the United States and His Most Christian Majesty, among others, it is stipulated that the great principle on which the armed neutrality in Europe was founded should prevail in case of future wars. The principle of this, that free ships may make free goods, and that vessels and goods shall be both free from condemnation. Great Britain did not recognize it. While all Europe was against her, she held out without acting on it. It has been considered for some time past that the flames of war already kindled would spread, and that France and England were likely to draw those swords which were recently put up. And so he's basically saying that, hey, we're still in this hostility. It's about to come. And why are we even? I'll have to editorialize on this. We'll bring this back up in our next episode. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am
trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.